I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Today, a conversation about college threat assessment teams. How do they work to prevent violence? But first, the violence in Baghdad is nearing levels seen before the U.S. troop surge. Nearly 170 people were killed today in a series of car bombs that went off in rapid succession in mainly Shiite neighborhoods. The bombings took place hours after Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki said that Iraq would soon take over security of the whole country by the end of the year. Well, joining us on the line from Baghdad is Sam Dagher of the Christian Science Monitor. And Sam, we understand this was a combination of parked and suicide car bombs on a bus, at a checkpoint, in a market. What are Iraqi leaders saying?
Well, not much, Robin. I mean, Iraqi state television was talking about Maliki's recent visit to Japan and South Korea, and was also talking about some trip by ministers and parliamentarians to Dubai to discuss a draft oil law that's under discussion in Parliament. So you get a sense there's maybe a disconnect between the government and what's really happening on the streets of Baghdad.
One attack in particular I want to ask you about, it seemed the deadliest. This is a parked car bomb that went off as a crowd of workers were trying to rebuild the Sadria market right in central Baghdad. 82 people at least were killed there. This was a market that had seen bombing before.
Absolutely. I mean, this is not new, and this is considered to be one of Baghdad's most popular markets.
And it had been bombed, as we said, in February. Well, you wrote a front-page story last week headlined, "Is Baghdad Safer? Yes and No." What do you mean?
Well, again, I mean, things change minute to minute. I mean, this is what one of the people I interviewed last week, you know, things might seem normal one minute, and then all hell could break loose. I mean, just last week, you know, people were beginning to take a breather a little bit. People were beginning to move around, you know, after weeks of being you know, locked down in their homes and not being able to go anywhere. And then suddenly we get that spectacular parliament bombing, the bridge bombing, and then this week. So very few people are going to venture out, you know, after all of this. So again, last week was different. It was, you know, people felt maybe they could move around a little bit. But again, tomorrow might be quiet again, and people might venture out again. But things change from minute to minute. I mean, this is the problem. It's very unpredictable. And again, it seems like, you know, the insurgents, the militants wanted to send a clear message to the world, you know, that despite what you're hearing from the government, from the U.S. forces, that, you know, the security plan is working and the level of violence is going down. In fact, it has gone down to some extent, but this is perhaps a message from these people to say, no, you know, we are still here, we're still able to hit and hit hard.
You write today that the Iraqi government will not collapse following the defection this week of six Shiite cabinet ministers, followers of the Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr, but that Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki will be undermined. Now, Defense Secretary Gates, traveling in the region, said that the defection is an opportunity to put better people in, and others have said they were just symbolic anyway. Why do you think that, in the few seconds we have, why do you think Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki will be undermined?
We're seeing some cracks emerging in the Shiite coalition, in the United Iraqi Alliance. This is the Maliki's coalition, tension within the own Shiite coalition itself. I mean, one analyst told me, as long as he enjoys the backing of, you know, one of the significant elements of his coalition, he may be able to survive. But, I mean, that remains to be seen.
Sam Dagher reports from Baghdad for the Christian Science Monitor. Sam, thank you very much.
You're most welcome.
In Blacksburg, Virginia, Police Chief Wendell Flincham said today that two Virginia Tech female students had accused Cho Sung Hui, the student who shot 32 others before killing himself, of stalking them in 2005. The first woman declined to press charges. When the second woman called police, they went to talk with Cho. Here's Chief Flincham.
Later that day, our department received a call from an acquaintance of Cho's who was concerned that Cho might be suicidal. Officers again met with Cho and talked with him at length. Out of concern for Cho, officers asked him to speak to a counselor. He went voluntarily to the police department. Based on that interaction with the counselor, a temporary detention order was obtained and Cho was taken to a mental health facility.
Several Virginia Tech professors have also said that Cho Sung-hui unsettled them. In one case, poet Nikki Giovanni asked that he be removed from her class. Professor Lucinda Roy said that when she volunteered to tutor Cho, she created a password that would alert colleagues to call the police. And Professor Roy went to the police, who told her their hands were tied because Cho Sung-hui had not made any implicit threat to anyone. Even with these troubling questions about his mental health, Cho Sung-hui was able to purchase firearms in Virginia, because as we just heard, he voluntarily went to a health facility, and reportedly only involuntary commitments prevent a gun purchase. Well, all of this is raising a lot of questions, and today we want to focus on a movement in colleges to form teams to track students who raise red flags. Paul Dillon is a retired police major from the University of Maryland College Park. Paul, as we understand it, the school has two ways of dealing with potential threats. The police department has a threat assessment team, and the university has a beta team that deals with behavioral problems. Tell us what the teams do.
First, the beta team is made up of public safety, the health center, and counseling professionals, and they handle behavioral issues. And what this team does is sort of a counseling. When somebody has an individual they're having trouble with, or they're having a behavioral concern about a student or a peer that they're working with, they can come to the beta team for advice on where to go and what to do. And a lot of times the behavioral issues are simple classroom disruption, a difficult student who's challenging the professor or something along those lines, and the beta team would guide that person to the appropriate university resource. Now, if it's a violent problem, then it would be turned over to the university police and the threat assessment team.
And tell us about the threat assessment team. We understand they trained in California?
Yeah, the threat assessment team started about 5 years ago at our agency, and we sent a group of officers to training out in California through a company called Gavin DeBecker and Associates.
And he's a well-known security expert.
Exactly, and these officers, a two-week training program, and we have a handful of officers who we sent to this training, and these officers handle any sort of threat assessments about individuals, students, faculty, staff, or anybody like that that is exhibiting behavior that might be violent, might turn to violence. And the goal of the threat assessment team is to analyze the situation, analyze the individual, and then predict whether the person is likely to become violent or not.
We understand there's a software program called Mosaic involved. How does that work?
Well, how that works is when a threat assessment officer works on a case, he or she will do things like interview people who have knowledge of the person, analyze the behavior, do research on the person's background, things like the person's marital status, their financial status, whether they were in the military, and all these sort of predicating questions that they would actually then put into the Mosaic program. And what the Mosaic program is it's real cases from across the country are put into this program. And as you enter the data about the individual you're doing the threat assessment on, it compares it to other similar situations across the country of real-life cases and whether they turn to violence or not. And then it would actually give you a score on a 1 to 10 basis of whether the person is likely to turn to violence as an alternative. Most people don't turn to violence as an alternative. Most people who exhibit threatening behavior are really just, you know, intimidating folks to get their way. But the different factors you put in can then lead us to believe a person might be an 8 out of 10 and that their behavior could turn to violence. And then we'll take steps to try to prevent that violence.
Well, let's get a case study. And while we do that, you know, some people hearing this might say, geez, this sounds terrible. These are kids at college, and suddenly there's sort of this big brother computer system, you know, crunching all of this information on them. And yet, do you have examples of when you've been able to prevent a potential act of violence?
Sure. We had a case about 4 years ago where an individual was exhibiting some strange behavior. He was a student. And we did a threat assessment on him, but the person hadn't committed any crime. So
what was the behavior?
He was just acting strange. He was making people uncomfortable. His writings were very bizarre, and people around him just, you know, whenever they had weird feelings around him and felt that he was very strange.
I don't want to draw too many parallels to Virginia Tech, a story that's still unfolding, but it sounds like Cho Sung-hui.
Well, Well, there are some eerie similarities, and this individual left the university not long after we did our assessment on him, and then about 6 months later then made a threat to come to the university and shoot at a building, at a specific building.
Is this Jeffrey Walensky who...
Yeah, and that's public record. So, yeah, Mr. Walensky made the threats. His lawyer turned the letter over to the FBI, who came to us, and we worked with the FBI and the Pennsylvania State Police, ended up serving arrests and search warrants. He had about 20 assault weapons that he had stored up in Pennsylvania. The FBI was able to get those weapons. We were able to charge the person federally with a crime that he was convicted of.
Well, and again, he wrote in a letter that he was going to shoot people at the university,
mm-hmm.
and he wrote the letter to his lawyer. And so when this comes up, he's already left the school. How did the threat assessment team, you know, help?
Well, we had the background from the original threat assessment that immediately helped. So we had done all the research on Mr. Walensky already. You know, the first thing we did when we found out about the threats is we went and secured the building. We put armed officers at each of the entrances. We met with the people in the building to inform them of the threat. And then we went looking for Mr. Walensky.
Because you already had everything about him on file.
Yeah, it was very, very helpful. It was really a good example of the threat assessment process working the way it should work.
Well, now, if he scored so high in your, you know, your coverage of him while he was a student, why couldn't you do anything then?
Well, as you alluded to earlier about you know, Big Brother watching and civil liberties and so forth, you have to commit a crime or violate some university regulation before action can be taken against you.
Do you really? I want to hold you up there because, mm-hmm. again, we don't want you to comment on Virginia Tech, but we want to point out that at Virginia Tech, there was a professor, Lucinda Roy, who said the same things you're saying about Jeff Walensky. The writing very much disturbed her. In fact, another professor, Nikki Giovanni, the poet, actually had Cho Song-hui removed from her class because he was disturbing so many other students there by his writings. And you're saying that Jeffrey Walensky, in the case of University of Maryland, was also, you know, disturbing people.
Mm-hmm.
Why couldn't you force him to have, for instance, mental health evaluation?
Well, in Maryland, in order to force a mental health evaluation, the person has to be a danger to themselves or others. So you have to have the articulable facts that a person is either going to hurt themselves by committing suicide or hurt others. And you have to have the behaviors that match that in order to commit somebody. I mean, even if you cannot do that, there are other things you can do. You can encourage the person to see a counselor. You can, you know, use, say, the influence of a dean or a teacher that the person might be friendly with to get them to see a mental health professional. So there are steps you can take, you know, to encourage the person to seek help on their own. As opposed to forcing them if you don't have the law behind you to force an evaluation upon an individual.
And as we know, the laws vary from state to state. Okay, when we come back, we want to dig into this a little more, this gray area of steps a school can take when a student doesn't explicitly say, you know, I'm going to shoot someone, but there is alarming behavior. We'll be back after a quick break with Paul Dillon. He's a retired police major from the University of Maryland, College Park. Much more on this really tough, tough issue. Here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we're back with retired police major Paul Dillon of the University of Maryland College Park, talking about steps schools can take to prevent violence. Before the break, we were talking about, you know, the netty difference between explicit threats and disturbing behavior. In the case of Virginia Tech, we've heard how English professor Lucinda Roy went to university police and said they couldn't take actions because even if the student's writing was frightening, it didn't contain any direct threats. Paul Dillon, we've spoken to the threat assessment team at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, for instance. They say to have a student hospitalized against their will, behavior can be interpreted as an imminent risk. For instance, setting a fire in a dorm room. Here in Massachusetts, a school can commit a student, and then it's the hospital's job to determine their health.
Each case is different, and each set of behaviors that the police might look at are different from individual to individual. So it's the totality of the evidence and the information that you put together on an individual that might lead you to say they're a danger to themselves, and it might give you the right to do what's called an emergency petition for evaluation in the state of Maryland, fill out the paperwork, and you can take that person into custody and take them to a hospital to be evaluated further.
Well, I guess I just want to pursue this one more second because this is, I think, the big question people have, which is it sounds like the behaviors you're describing of Jeffrey Walensky in your case. In hindsight, do you think he should have been a candidate for being forced into evaluation?
We did not have enough evidence or enough information at the time to force him. And it's a serious thing when you force somebody in evaluation. This is a free country. You're basically taking their rights away to be free by taking them into custody. So you don't do it lightly. You don't just say, you know, somebody's weird, that they wrote a disturbing story, so let's put them in handcuffs and take them to a hospital. So you have to make sure that you have the facts to support your theory that the person's a danger to themselves or others.
Can you give us some other instances where somebody has gone into help, where it hasn't turned into the Jeffrey Walensky story, where, as you say, he was arrested ultimately, but someone who was able to stay in the school? How do you work with someone who's going to stay in the school and is still making people uneasy?
If they've committed a crime or a violation of a university regulation, we get them into that system, whether it be the criminal justice system or the university judicial system, if they've violated some sort of rule or regulation or law. That's one step we take. And the other steps we take are we work very closely with the health center and the counseling center and the Office of Resident Life to try to get students who are experiencing some mental difficulties, the help that they need, whether it be a resident director or RA or somebody encouraging the person to see a mental health professional. The university has many resources. I mean, there are a lot of students on our campus that have emotional and mental health issues. And the goal of the university is to help these individuals with these mental health issues so they can, you know, get on with their studies and be productive and to learn at the university. It's not necessarily, we don't look to target them to throw them out. There are quite a number of students who come to our university that have mental health problems, whether they're on medication for depression or bipolar disorder or whatever it may be. But you know, the university recognizes that these people are, you know, can be productive students and aren't necessarily a danger. So it's to try to help these students to be productive and to get the help that they need.
And I need to hasten to say a little disclosure. As someone, you know, with a loved one who has mental health issues, it's difficult for anyone. It's difficult for everyone to try to ascertain what's going on and try to get someone to get help, never mind in a college setting.
Yeah, and more students are at our universities that have mental health issues than in prior years. Say 20 years ago, many of these students who had depression or bipolar disorder, where the medication and the treatment was not as good as it is now, weren't able to qualify to get into schools of higher education. They couldn't succeed in high school. But right now, we have good professional doctors, psychiatrists, psychologists, and also the medicines to help these students cope. Because, as you know, a lot of these mental disorders are physiological in nature, and they're treatable. And so you have students who are able to succeed prior to secondary education so they can get into a school like the University of Maryland where they can get an education. But a lot of times it's difficult for some of our students who are now away from home. They don't have the support of their family anymore that's helping them with their mental health.
Lucinda Roy, who, again, was the English teacher who found Cho Sung-hui's behavior so disturbing that she came up with a password when she tutored him so that she could say that word if she wanted her colleagues to call for help for her. Another professor, Nikki Giovanni, we mentioned, had removed him from her class. She said she'd quit if he wasn't removed. So this was obviously a big issue. And then we understand, according to Lucinda Roy, that it sort of went away. She didn't even know that Cho was still on the campus. Mm-hmm. How much is follow-up and maintaining contact with these students a part of your plan? I mean, how do you work that in the plan?
Well, it's an important part of it, because as you deal with students who you think might be a threat to other individuals or to themselves, and most of the time these individuals are actually threats to themselves as opposed to other people, is you want to keep track of the person and to find out, you know, what they're doing in the university, how they're coping, and so forth. So you want to stay in touch with them, find out where they are, find out, you know, how they're coping, if they've gotten better, if they're, you know, adjusted to their problems and so forth. So it's good to keep track of them, but, you know, you're not following them around every day to see what they're doing.
I mean, I guess I'm asking, once someone enters the radar of the beta group or the threat assessment group, do they stay in that radar until they graduate?
I would say that no. It depends on how the outcome of the evaluation of the incident. We had another individual who threatened a teacher with a gun several years ago. who was, we did a threat assessment on, ended up arresting him and kicking him out of school. So we did track him because, we wanted him out of the campus, and we were successful in getting him kicked off the campus.
Paul Dillon, who served on the University of Maryland College Park's Beta Team, a group that worked with kids with behavior problems on campus. Paul, thanks for speaking with us.
Oh, thank you, Robin.
And, of course, that's another whole segment, what happens when kids are expelled from school and they have a problem. Where do they go then? Well, we'll continue to follow this story, all its ramifications. But this quick note, tomorrow on Here and Now, actress and activist Mia Farrow on Darfur. Is her pressure having an effect? Also, Alberto Gonzalez goes before Congress to explain his role in the firing of 8 federal prosecutors. That's all tomorrow. Still ahead, much more Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. We've spoken here of global warming as a health issue, as an environmental issue, of course, and now as a security issue. Global climate change threatens America's national security and may affect the war on terrorism. That's the conclusion of a study conducted by a Blue Ribbon panel made up of a group of retired admirals and generals. General Gordon Sullivan was on the panel. He's one of the Army's chief of staff in the early 90s when the Army conducted Operation Restore Hope in Somalia, most noted by Americans for what came to be called the Black Hawk Down incident. Currently, he's president and chief operating officer of the Association of the U.S. Army, and he joins us. And General Sullivan, your report says that as climate change redistributes water and other scarce resources, we're going to see conflicts, massive migrations, border tensions.
Robin, you got it. You got it. And if you go to Darfur in the Sudan, you can find at the base of that the same issue where herdsmen and farmers clash. One thing leads to another. And then you have populations moving around from one country to another. All of the countries are not very stable.
And how would that directly affect the military? I'm thinking, for instance, of, let's say, rising waters. Your report points out that this might mean that military groups will have to do more rescue efforts and evacuation efforts than
before.
Well,
that's correct. Well, let's just look at, where are you now? You're in Boston?
Mm-hmm.
The National Guard was called out during this spring storm, the Northeast spring storm. 1,500 troops in New York, about 500 in Massachusetts, some in New Jersey and Maine. Now, I don't know. I wouldn't be foolish enough, and I'm not a scientist. I don't know why a storm like this occurred. But the point I want to make is that in many of these environmentally related activities, we find the National Guard and in some cases even regular Army soldiers involved in the rescue and stability activities.
This will affect the military in ways we might not have thought of. For instance, rising sea levels will affect many of the coastal bases. That's where the military is based, on the coasts.
That's correct. Diego Garcia, which is a very important base in the Indian Ocean, is frankly almost at sea level as it is. I think one of the most important things that we're saying is that climate change is a threat multiplier for instability in some of the most volatile regions of the world.
Well, in fact, I just want to pick up on that. As you point out, water is already a critical issue, for instance, in the Middle East, where there's fighting over water resources. Global warming can't help that.
It doesn't help it. As you know, most of the water in the Middle East comes out of Turkey and northern Syria. You know, the Tigris, the Euphrates, and the Jordan River all emanate from those mountains. And as snow cap is less, the water is less.
You and the people that you worked with on this panel try to think into the future, not only, asking, for instance, would the Air Force have to not only evacuate people from areas, but maybe bring food into areas, try to get water to U.S. troops in different battles around the world. But things like thinking through whether or not in the Arctic, if the warming there continues, there'd be a possibility of a new sea route, a new Northwest Passage. Well, tell us a little more about that, kind of trying to think outside the box, the effects of global warming. What would that mean?
If there is a new Northwest Passage, obviously the Canadians and the Russians and people who butt up against that passage would feel that that was their passage, and that could open up new ports, new routes, and protection of sea lanes, and of course loss of habitat. There's all sorts of things to consider, and I think what I would say is, look, we're not scientists. We're officers who served in the Army, Navy, Air Force, and Marines. And frankly, given our proclivity anyway, we said the trends don't look very good, and we didn't argue about it. We listened, we asked critical questions, and we came to the opinion that the national security consequences of climate change should be fully integrated into our national security and national defense strategies.
Give us an example of how, you know, in those recommendations, how you recommend that be done. Just one, because I know you probably have many. But
global partnerships.
Yeah.
The United States should commit to global partnerships that help less developed nations build the capacity and resiliency to better manage climate impacts. Look, we all know that the Dutch have been able to hold the North Sea off for years. The United States is doing some things down in the Gulf to do that. But we're industrialized nations with great wealth, and we can do some of those things. But the nations we're worried about are the ones that can't do it. And I think we need to develop partnerships with them and commit to global partnerships.
General, it's interesting in reading parts of the report. You mentioned that you guys didn't debate global warming. You just thought through what the trends are going to mean. And it is fascinating. You know, if glaciers melt and water temperatures change, could that affect submarine equipment such as sonar? If there is more frequency of intense hurricanes, could that destabilize the Navy if they have to move ships to avoid hurricanes? Fascinating list, but most of the questions prefaced with the word could. Could it? What do you say to people who do say, who are still debating global warming, who say we're not 100%, you know, sure?
It's what I say. Look, I was a soldier for 36 years. If I waited around for 100% certainty, I'd be still waiting. I think people like us need to understand that, first of all, this is America, and there's lots of different opinions on any given subject, but at some point, somebody has to do something. And I think certainly myself, and I think I'm speaking for the other members of the panel, we felt that the trends were in such a direction that it was time to just come to grips with it and make the recommendations we did based on what we know. If we stand around and wait for 100% certainty, it may be too late.
And General, you write in many places, you and your panelists, that global warming will destabilize countries, many countries that are already destabilized. And we know that that is not good for, you know, what destabilized countries produce. But can you make the direct link between global warming, destabilized countries because of global warming, and terrorism?
I was the chief during the Somalia episode. And I think if you went back and stripped all of that down to its their roots, you'd find that the drought, the famine, that created a very unstable environment that fueled the behavior of the warlords who were related to the tribes. And the dominant warlord was able to get the food under control, and that's where we saw that the image which finally brought us in, which was the vulture looking at the young child with a distended stomach.
Yes.
And at the heart of that, I mean, we have this failed state, and it is now a source for Al-Qaeda activities as they develop tentacles into Africa. So anyway, I would say, yeah, that's where I would draw the probably the best example. And I think Darfur is also, the Sudan is also another one, and it's not good.
General Gordon Sullivan. General Sullivan was Chief of Staff of the Army, member of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Presently, he's President and Chief Operating Officer of the Association of the U.S. Army. General Sullivan, thank you very much.
Hey, Robin, thanks a lot for what you're doing. I love NPR and all of your stuff.
Well, thank you very much. All right, then. Well, before we go, folk icon David Bromberg, you're listening to Here and Now. Here's what the Pulitzer Prize Committee wrote about our next guest in awarding him $10,000 for his reporting on national affairs. Awarded to Charlie Savage of the Boston Globe for his revelations that President Bush often used signing statements to assert his controversial rights to bypass provisions of new laws. Well, joining us from Washington is Charlie Savage of the Boston Globe. Our congratulations, Charlie. And that pretty much summed up the writing, didn't it?
Well, actually, it doesn't pretty much sum up the writing in the sense that only about half the package was about signing statements, and the other half of the package were about other manifestations of the Bush administration's efforts to expand presidential power.
Well, that is true. And you spoke to us while this was unfolding, while you were writing this. I just want to ask, we want to learn more about where the story is now, but had you ever even heard of a signing statement when you started reporting on it?
No. The first story I wrote about the signing statement back in January of 2006 was the one that Bush had attached to the new McCain torture ban after signing it into law at the very end of December 2005. I've been following that story just because I'm very interested in 9/11 related legal issues, and I thought the story was over when the bill got signed, and it turned out, you know, the whole months of negotiation with Congress had been a farce because Bush thought that as commander-in-chief, it didn't matter what Congress thought.
And that's sort of paraphrasing, but the proof is in the signing statement. What did he, after the ban on torture was passed, what did President Bush's signing statement say?
Like all signing statements, it's very technical and legally dense, but what it amounted to was that I'm the head of the unitary executive branch, I'm the commander-in-chief. If I think that using harsh interrogation techniques are in the interest of the country, we'll stop terrorist attacks, I will do so regardless of what this new statute says.
An official told you at the time, and I remember in the article, that the president felt he needed to have this just in case he wanted to overturn the law. If, in fact, there was a ticking time bomb suspect that he wanted to authorize torture on.
Yeah, well, they would never say torture. They would always say, you know, alternative set of procedures. Mm-hmm. But yes, I talked to a White House official at the time because they didn't know how much attention was going to be put on this. And so they were pretty candid and said, we don't at this moment anticipate that we're going to do this tomorrow, but that if a scenario arises in which they thought that harsher techniques could stop a terrorist attack, his duty to protect the country would override Congress's power to regulate what the government can do to protect the country.
And further, people who, you know, pointed out to you in response to your first article that other presidents have done this, what did you then find about President Bush's use of signing statements?
There were three ways in which what he was doing, has been doing, is doing, is unprecedented. The first is the sheer number of challenges. At the time I wrote my main article about it in April, it was over 750. It's now over 1,100 separate provisions of law that he's challenged and said he need not obey as written. All previous presidents in American history combined added up to about 600. The second way is just and is related to that, those numbers, is the sheer aggression of the legal theory that he's advancing about a president's unilateral powers, partially summed up by the phrase unitary executive theory, which has been more in current lately. He's using signing statements as one of the mechanisms by which he's trying to integrate this view, which most scholars across the ideological spectrum disagree with, into the mainstream. And then third way in which it's unique is that he has almost completely abandoned his veto power. He finally vetoed the stem cell research bill last year. It was the first time in 6 years he had vetoed anything. And so what many legal scholars and the American Bar Association said was that signing statements were morphing into a substitute for the veto, a sort of unilateral, because that Congress doesn't get a chance to override it, and line item, because he can sort of select pieces of a bill and just declare them null, and there's nothing anyone can do about it. There's no mechanism for rejecting that judgment.
Charlie, the American Bar Association has asked the White House to put an end to the signing statements. Congress has held hearings, but it sounds as if they are still being used in the same way they were when you first wrote about them.
Well, I mean, yes and no. Certainly the White House has not declared they have any intent of getting rid of them. On the other hand, there hasn't been a lot of legislation that's reached the president's desk yet because of the new Congress. But sooner or later, there's going to be some legislation that's going to reach him that he's going to sign. And under the old way of doing things, he would certainly attach signing statements to it. It'll be interesting to see whether he continues that provocative stance in 2007.
Journalist Charlie Savage of the Boston Globe, who just won a Pulitzer Prize for his reporting on President Bush's use of signing statements. Charlie, thanks, and congratulations again.
Thank you so much.
And also you can look for Charlie's upcoming book. It's called Takeover. It's about what he calls the Bush-Cheney effort to expand presidential power. Well, up next, musician David Bromberg returns here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Quick, who's this?
Early this morning, just about fall, my used-to-be come knocking on my door. She come crying, try me one more time.
If you're a certain age, there's a good chance you're being transported back in time listening to David Bromberg. David Bromberg was just a teenager when he started taking guitar lessons from the legendary blind musician Reverend Gary Davis. In exchange, Bromberg guided the Reverend around New York City. Presumably, Bromberg was a good guide, but he turned into a great guitarist. David Bromberg later played Woodstock, gigged with the Grateful Dead, Bob Dylan and Ringo Starr, wrote a song with George Harrison, led his own big band around the world playing blues, folk, bluegrass, and ragtime. Then in 1980, David Bromberg packed it in to learn how to make violins. And for the past 20 years, he's been selling and collecting antique violins in Wilmington, Delaware, and jamming with local musicians, including an assistant principal, a social worker, and Full Circle, a talented teenage kid. 26 years after dropping out of the limelight, David Bromberg is back with Try Me One More Time, a new CD featuring himself, his guitar, and his long memory of the blues. And David Bromberg joins us now from WKY in Lexington, Kentucky. Welcome.
Thank you.
And I'd ask, where have you been? But we just sort of heard. But do you get that a lot from people, too? Where you've been? Where have you been? You were such an important part of a time in my life.
Well, I got burnt out, and I didn't recognize it as burnout, or I just would have taken 6 months or a year off. I thought it was over. It never occurred to me that I could be burnt out. I just thought I wasn't a musician anymore, and I didn't want to phone it in, you know, go on. Because it was all I knew. So I decided it was time to find a new life.
Well, and we'll talk about that life, but on the flip side, so why now? Why a new CD, and why solo, and why now?
Well, when I moved to Wilmington, Delaware, I started a couple of jam sessions in town, and fantastic musicians just started showing up, really wonderful musicians. Mm-hmm. And I started to really, really enjoy playing. The record was a complete accident.
Yeah, how do you make an accidental record?
I actually started out to record some Gary Davis tunes. I did a show in Texas with Herb Peterson and Chris Hillman. When I told them that I used to be one of Gary Davis's lead boys, they asked me if I could play that stuff. And I hadn't played it in quite a while, but strangely, I still could. And they said, oh, you've got to be doing that. So I figured I'd go into the studio and record one or two of those tunes. And once I started, I just kept doing a few more. And I never went in for more than a couple hours at a time. And my wife would come in and listen, and she picked out the stuff that worked and made a record out of. Boys, I got a kind-hearted woman. Girl, do anything in the world for me. Yeah, but you know these evil-hearted women. Oh, they just will not let me be.
People that you've come across in this, you know, in the sort of out of the limelight time in your life, must have thought they'd died and gone to heaven. You know, it's David Bromberg, who'd played with Dylan and whose music
I think that they were much more interested in having a violin shop there.
That takes us to the second part of the story, which is that you had this passion for violins. Where does that come from?
The violin, once you start with it, it can take over. Most guitar players I know who started to play a little fiddle, it took over completely. When I was living in California, I'd started playing a little fiddle, so I'd go down to the violin shop, and I was fascinated by the fact that people could look at a violin and say when and where it was made, and sometimes by whom. And I wanted to be able to do that. And that's what I've been studying for over 20 years now.
All right. And you have a tremendous collection there. People come to buy them from you. But with you right now in the studio, you have your guitar, which, again, as you said, you know, you've had this, your interest in music jump-started and made new. So we'd love to hear a little from you. I'd love to hear a little bit of the Reverend Gary Davis song. It's called I Belong to the Band. Maybe you could play just a portion of that for us now. It'd be great.
I'll play a little bit of I Belong to the Band. There's another Gary Davis tune on there, too, called Trying to Get Home.
Right.
Hallelujah, I belong to the band. Hallelujah. 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 I belong to the band. Hallelujah. What kind of band are you talking about? Talking about a union band. I belong to the band. Hallelujah. Talk to me.
That's one of the Reverend Gary Davis tunes on the new CD from David Bromberg. It's a collection of gospel, folk, blues tunes from Robert Johnson to Bob Dylan. Well, and you were a member of the late 1960s revivals that first introduced people to artists like Blind Willie McTell, Elizabeth Cotton, who, I think I have this right, taught traditional folk tunes to Pete Seeger?
Elizabeth Cotton worked for Charles Seeger, Pete's mom and dad, and I'm not sure whether she worked as cook or cleaning person or exactly what her function was, but it was as some kind of help. And she was discovered one day, she'd picked up somebody's guitar and was playing on it. They had no idea that she was musical. And that's how Elizabeth Cotton was discovered.
Let's listen to your take on her, Shake Sugary.
I've got a secret I shouldn't tell. I'm gonna go to heaven in a split pea shell. Oh Lord, in me, didn't we shake up sugary? Everything I had done and gone.
Shake Sugary, written by Elizabeth Cotton, but David Bromberg, how did it make its way to you?
I really liked Fred Neil's version of it, and he was from Coconut Grove and had this great deep baritone voice. And so I kind of do a version of Fred Neil's version of Elizabeth Cotton's Shake Sugary.
How does it feel to be back with a CD, you know, edging towards the limelight, something that you turned your back on?
Well, I never really considered that I turned my back on it. I didn't think of it in those terms, but I suppose you're right that I did. You know, I have a very interesting life, and it's much nicer for me and much more pleasant not having a career. If I'm getting close to the limelight, like the breaking of the record, it's accidental. I'm doing things in a comfortable way, and if it brings limelight, fine. If it doesn't, that's also fine. I don't have anything riding on this, which is kind of the central thing about the feel of the CD, too. It's not a fussy CD, and I wasn't trying to prove anything on it. I just did things the way I do them.
Right. Well, we started with Try Me One More Time, which we're doing. What would you like us to leave with?
How about Takes a Lot to Laugh, Takes a Train to Cry?
That's, of course, a Bob Dylan song. We're going to leave you with David Bromberg's version. His new CD is Try Me One More Time. And, David, thanks so much for spending some time with us. We've missed you.
Oh, that's very nice. I haven't missed you because I listen to you all the time.
Oh.
So it's really an honor to be on the show. Thank you very much.
Oh, don't the sun look good setting over the sea? And don't my gal look fine coming after me?
Who knew? Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
PRI, Public Radio International.